Good afternoon, everyone. I first want to give a very warm Foreign Club welcome to the wife of our speaker today, Kathleen Card, who actually could have given the invocation because Kathleen is a United Methodist Reverend. And they met in the fifth grade. Boy, talk about stability. That's really something. But now I'm delighted to introduce a former colleague. We worked together in the Reagan White House. But then, as I'm sure you all read in his incredible bio, you know that he not only served President Reagan, but several other presidents as a cabinet secretary, ran the Republican National Convention, finally served as the second longest serving White House chief of staff for President George W. Bush. What you probably don't know, though, is how he got there, what experiences he had, who influenced his life, and how do these guys get to where they're going? Students, you might want to take a note on this. First of all, just like this young student we had here from Naples High, his father encouraged him to join the Boy Scouts. And he worked and worked to become an Eagle Scout, but you know what? He fell one badge short. Now, which one did he miss? The one for citizenship and community service. Go figure. But I think the biggest influence in his life was actually his grandmother. Now, we might have a few grandparents here today, so you can appreciate this one. Turns out, his grandmother, Elizabeth Card, was a suffragette back in Massachusetts. She marched on Commonwealth Avenue back in 1918 for the right to vote. So she was front and center in a very public way, but in a private way, she had a heck of an influence on the kids. What she did was she made Andy read stories in the newspaper, yes, kids read newspapers in those days, about public policy. And then he had to report back and tell her what he read. This created a true believer in government ideas and public service. Oh, and by the way, not too long ago, a local Boy Scout troop decided that by now he had put in enough time as a public servant to get the last badge. So, please give a warm Naples welcome to a longest-serving White House chief of, second longest-serving White House chief of staff and Eagle Scout, Andy Card.
Thank you, Carter, and thank you, Dick. Thank you all for the invitation to be here. I feel truly honored to come and speak with you. That was a very kind introduction, unlike any that I've had before. So I am struck by how my grandmother really did have an influence on my life. She was an amazing woman. She was very well-educated for her day, and she was someone who was a militant suffragette and literally marched for women to get the right to vote. And growing up, she would tell us about the journey of women getting the right to vote, and she would preface her remarks always by saying the most important word in the Constitution is actually the very first word, we. And she said, when I was your age, we was not an all-inclusive word. When women got the right to vote, it became an all-inclusive word. And she said that the most important document other than the Bible happens to be the U.S. Constitution. And she said the U.S. Constitution is a remarkable document because it creates a government of the people, by the people, for the people. But the document doesn't obligate you to do anything unless you accept the invitation. You're not obligated to vote. You're not obligated to run for office. You're not really obligated to do much of anything, although up and through the Vietnam War, we did have the draft. But now there's no obligation. It's just an invitation. And if you accept the invitation, then there's an obligation. And my grandmother told us, all of the grandchildren, that we should accept that invitation. So I could not wait to be able to register to vote. I couldn't wait to run for office. Guess what, though? I went to college and was trained under a Navy ROTC scholarship at the University of South Carolina as an engineer. And I worked as a structural design engineer at the same time that I was accepting the invitation to participate in our government. And I did not know that if you were an engineer and a politician, you're an oxymoron. So I don't know whether I'm the oxy or the moron. But I did work as a structural design engineer, but I also was passionate about participating in our political system. And so politics was not a dirty word for me growing up. It was a noble calling. And I wish today that more people saw service in government, especially elective government, as a noble calling. I really did grow up with a grandmother who said, maybe you could grow up to be president someday. Almost nobody today says, I hope my grandchild gets into politics. But the truth is, we need everyone in politics for that word we to mean what it really means. So my message to you, if you remember nothing else, is say yes to the invitation. Register to vote. Vote. Run for office. Bring fresh ideas. Have the courage to exercise judgment and demand it. No matter what your age, get involved. Many of you should be more involved than you are because we also need the wisdom you have. So that's critically important. But I want to talk about the invitation. I ran for office when I got out of college, graduated in January of 1971. I was supposed to be on the four-year plan. I wasn't that good of a student, and it took me a little bit longer. Moved back to Massachusetts from Columbia, South Carolina, where the University of South Carolina is, and I filed to be a candidate. And I ran for the planning board in Holbrook, Massachusetts, five-year term, no pay, Thursday nights, cul-de-sacs, curb cuts, lots of arguments. I also then ran for the state legislature. And I got elected in 1974. Most of you do remember 1974. That was actually the worst time to be a Republican. It was the height of the ramifications of Watergate. And I chose to run for state representative in a community that had six times more Democrats than Republicans in it. And I ran as a Republican, and I remember going to see my dad and said, I think I'm going to run for state representative. And he was a member of the Republican Town Committee in Holbrook, and he said, as a Republican? And I said, yes, of course. He said, I don't think you can get elected. The good news is my opponent didn't think I could get elected either. And he did not campaign very much. The other good news is I had no money. So I couldn't run ads. So he couldn't see that I was campaigning. But I did have good feet in good shoes, and I walked the pavement. And I knocked on doors. And I sent notes back to everyone whose door I knocked on, even if they weren't home when I knocked on the door. And I ended up getting 67% of the vote and became the only Republican in New England in 1974 to defeat an incumbent Democrat. That was saying yes to the invitation. I had the privilege of serving for 8 years in the Massachusetts House. Six of the 8 years, I was the Republican whip. There aren't many people to whip in the Massachusetts House if you're a Republican. I then decided to run for governor. It was a completely forgettable campaign to everyone except for me and my wife. But running for governor and doing better than anticipated and not ending the campaign with any debt, because I wouldn't let my campaign spend money we didn't have, was a phenomenally rewarding experience. And I remember the day after the election, I went to Boston to hold a press conference at a hotel. And I'm standing on the stage at the hotel, and the press is there, and some of my campaign volunteers are there. And I said I was very proud of my third place finish in the Republican primary for governor. And my son, who was about 5 years old at the time, yanks my pant leg, standing right beside me. He says, "Dad, you came in last." I preferred to think of it as third. And I was very proud of that campaign. And then about 2 days later, I received a phone call that was kind of what my grandmother had anticipated, because it was a phone call that was inviting me to serve. It came from someone I have tremendous respect for, James A. Baker III. And he was chief of staff to President Ronald Reagan. And he said, "Andy, would you like to come work for President Reagan in Washington, D.C.? That is a great invitation. I ended up going to Washington, D.C. I had the privilege of working with Carna in the Reagan White House. Jay Stevens was in the White House. And it was a phenomenal opportunity. My title was Special Assistant to the President for Intergovernmental Affairs, liaison to governors and statewide elected officials. And then I realized the longer the title, the less important you are. But it was a great invitation. And I remember driving my little red 1976 Chevy Chevette with rusted floorboards into West Executive Avenue, and the gates would open up, and my parking spot was right next to the Vice President's limousine. And I said, "Please do not pinch me. This is too beautiful. I don't want to wake up." But what an invitation. But I'm going to fast forward, because you didn't invite me to come speak here because I answered that invitation. You invited me to speak because of another invitation. And I'm going to point out, and I'm going to say this particularly to the students, much of what happens in politics is because you have the courage to get involved. Seldom is it because you applied to be involved. I guess you have to apply to run for office, but it's really, you're going to run for office. But be honest with you, if you're going to be the chief of staff to the President of the United States, you don't apply for it. I don't know any president that went to like ZipRecruiter or Monster.com looking for a chief of staff. But I received that invitation. And the truth is, I received the invitation before I recognized that it was an invitation. So I'm going to tell you a quick story. I don't want to get sidetracked with it. I had served at the White House for President Reagan and President George H.W. Bush, thanks to some phenomenal invitations and great opportunities. And yes, I was Secretary of Transportation for the last year of George H.W. Bush. Before that, I was Deputy White House Chief of Staff. Before that, I had worked in the Reagan administration and that long-titled Special Assistant, and then a shorter title, Deputy Chief of Staff and Director of the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs. But I was in the private sector. And actually, Bob Eaton is here. Where's Bob Eaton? Way over there. Bob Eaton was one of my bosses. I ran the trade association for GM, Ford, and Chrysler. And Bob Eaton was on the board of that trade association. And the board was made up of the chairman and CEO of each of the companies, and the number two person at each company, and me. And no substitutes were permitted at the board meeting, so I had the privilege of working with Bob Eaton when he couldn't send a substitute to the meeting. He always showed up because the CEOs of the three companies don't trust each other. But it was a great experience. But fast forward to the year 2000, I was working with the automobile industry, and I received a call from Governor George W. Bush. He asked if I would run the convention in Philadelphia, in Philadelphia, for the convention for the Republican Party. And so I ran that convention, and I wasn't the most welcome person when I showed up in Philadelphia. The convention had been run by a lot of people from the party, and then I came in to take it over and have it be all about the Republican nominee. And we worked hard to put the convention together. And on the night that George W. Bush was accepting the Republican nomination, I am at the convention hall. Everything is all set. I get a call from the advance person with the motorcade and saying, Governor Bush is on his way to the convention hall, and he wants you to greet him when he gets out of the limousine. And I said, that is not the plan. He's arriving by driving into an area just outside the convention hall, but inside the building, and there will be cameras all set up, and he's getting out of the limousine, and he's going to greet delegates to the convention that represents the demographics and the geographics of our party. So he'll be greeted by those people. So no, I won't be there to greet the governor when he gets out of the limousine. About 3 minutes later, he had a call back. Governor Bush wants you to greet him when he gets out of the limousine at the convention hall. I said, I will stand at the end of the line off camera. He said, fine. He drives into the convention hall. The door is opened by the Secret Service. He gets out. He goes down the line shaking hands, appreciating the delegates that are there. And then he comes over to me, and I'm standing kind of off camera, trying to hide behind a blue drape. And he comes over, puts his arm around me, says, great convention, thanks for what you're doing. Walk with me to the green room. And I said, Governor, this is supposed to be a long, lonely walk to the green room where you're by yourself, there are cameras set up along the way, and you're contemplating this wonderful opportunity to be the leader of the Republican Party and candidate for President of the United States. And he says, walk with me. About halfway down this walk, as we're talking about the speech he's going to give, he says, Andy, I want you to keep your dance card clear. And I'm thinking, what's he talking about? I said, okay, I'll keep my dance card clear. He said, oh, great, great. I've got something for you to do. And I said, well, let's go to the green room. Let's practice your speech one more time. We went, practiced the speech. I go up to the convention hall, watch him deliver his speech. Very good speech. Ambassador Sandy Rant is there. And I'm excited to see all the people welcome our candidate. And then I go back to my work. He goes to the hotel. The next morning he shows up at a prayer breakfast. I see him backstage before he goes into the prayer breakfast. He says, don't forget, I want you to call Clay Johnson. I've got something I want you to do. And I said, oh, thank you very much. He said, oh, what a great convention. And then he goes into the prayer breakfast. After the prayer breakfast, he gets on a train, and Karen Hughes wrote a book about it, 10 Minutes to Normal, Normal, Illinois, campaign trip. The campaign had begun. I went back to the automobile industry. And I'm working, and then I get a call about 3 weeks later from Governor Bush saying, Andy, the debate negotiations for the president debates aren't going very well. Could you take them over? I said, I've used all my vacation time, all the time I can get off. I can give you a couple afternoons. He said, oh, should be easy. 2 afternoons, it'll be done. The negotiations weren't going very well. It took much longer than it should have. We finally did come to an agreement, but by then I was not welcomed at the automobile industry anymore. So I left the automobile industry and I jumped in with both feet to the campaign. The first debate was in Boston. And on the boat ride from Logan Airport over to the Kennedy School, the Kennedy Library, where the debate was held, we're sitting on the boat with all of these people going across the harbor, and Governor Bush was completely preoccupied with talking to me about calling Clay Johnson. I did not know Clay Johnson, and I kept saying to him, get your head in the game. That was the debate where neither candidate won. I think Al Gore had a little too much makeup on. He looked a little orange. But it was it wasn't decisive at all. And then the next debate happened to be with two elderly gentlemen sitting in chairs in Lexington, Kentucky. And it was the vice presidential debate. And then the next debate was at Wake Forest. Who wants to go to Wake Forest? Right there, Wake Forest. And it was a wonderful debate on foreign policy, and I showed up to motivate the students to come out and participate in rallies and get everybody going. This is a foreign policy debate. The governor shows up. He gets out of the limousine. He said, you didn't call Clay Johnson. I said, foreign policy, short answers, taste your words before you spit them out. Which is my mantra for anybody who runs for office, especially president. Today I should add, lick your thumbs before you hit the send button. The last debate was in St. Louis. And there was a pall in the air, because the governor had died in a plane crash. And there was a negotiations, do you even have the debate? Do you move it to another state? We deferred to the family of the governor. And they said, have the debate. The Gore campaign was panicked, and they wanted to renegotiate a lot of things about the debate. They knew that George W. Bush did not like cold, so they said turn the air conditioning way up. They wanted the podiums changed a little bit. So there's negotiations at the bitter end just before the debate is about to begin. Then I get the word from the Secret Service that Governor Bush is on his way. And I go out and greet the limousines that comes in. He gets out of the limousine and he grabs me by my cheeks. These cheeks, not these cheeks. And he says, you didn't call Clay Johnson. Clay Johnson is speaking for me. I said, get your head in the game. This is the debate where the audience is asking you questions. You pay attention to that audience. Don't worry about your opponent. Don't worry about the TV cameras. You focus on the people that are asking you the questions. That was the debate that he did really well at, because Vice President Gore broke the rules, left his podium, and walked in front of Governor Bush. And all Governor Bush did was just look at him and then look right back at the audience that was asking the questions. I happen to believe you seldom win a debate on merit. You win it by performance. And I think he won that debate. And we were excited. And as he's leaving the debate, he says, call Clay Johnson. I come home. I hadn't been home. My wife is a saint, and she was, I'd been on the road for 7 weeks. Couldn't wait to see her. I arrived home late. I wanted to make a nice romantic, I wanted to take her off for a nice romantic dinner, but I got home too late, so I made a nice romantic breakfast the next morning. I actually had a flower on the table, bagels, cream cheese. It was very nice. She came down, and I said, oh, I got to tell you all about the campaign. And it was George Bush this, that. That was just, and she said, are you married to me or are you married to George W. Bush? And the phone rang. And my wife answered the phone, and she says, it's George W. Bush. And he says to me, you didn't call Clay Johnson. Bottom line is, I ended up going to see Clay Johnson in Austin, Texas. I was told to see only Clay Johnson, don't go to the campaign headquarters, and then to call Governor Bush on the road, who was campaigning in Florida. I went and saw Clay Johnson, collected a whole bunch of books that were transition books. I had run the transition out of government for his dad. I said, they want me to do the transition. I've seen these books before. I'll do it. I call him up at the end of the day. He said, how'd the meeting with Clay go? I told him I could tell he'd already heard from Clay. And then he said, come see me, but I want you to go see my parents before that. I'm thinking, that's a little strange. I said, okay. He said, so meet me in Tampa, St. Pete for dinner Wednesday night. And I said, okay. But go see my parents first. I go see his parents. That's a long story. But the next day, I fly to Tampa. I had to go through Atlanta, missed my flight, ended up getting there too late to see him that night. So on Thursday morning, that's when he said to me, how'd the meeting with my parents go? I said, great. He said, so, do you think you want to do it? And I said, if you want me to run your transition, I'd be glad to run your transition. But he said, I'm not talking about that one. I'm talking about the big one. I knew what he meant. He wanted me to be his chief of staff. You know what happened election night. It came and didn't go away until the Supreme Court decided what would happen. But he asked me to be his chief of staff. So what's a chief of staff's job? Number one, the care and feeding of the president. I had worked for every chief of staff that served Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush. I knew the job of chief of staff. I'd seen the best of them, Jim Baker. I learned something from every one of them. Care and feeding of the president is the number one responsibility. You don't even think about that. But you all should be president because you're very well cared for. But it's a 24-hour, seven-day-a-week responsibility. Policy formulation is the next part of the job. That's what you do think the job is about, and you all argue about it. And the truth is, it's a relatively easy task for a chief of staff because the chief of staff doesn't make up the policy. He makes sure, or she makes sure, other people do it, and that there's no monolithic thinking. Because it should never be easy. If it's too easy, the president's wasting his time. Tough policy, so I view that job as more about the process of policy. You do the job so that people understand the consequence of the policy before it's adopted, so you have fewer unintended consequences. So a process is critically important, something we didn't see happen with the first immigration bill, executive order that came out. The process allowed for that particular executive order to be defined by unintended consequences rather than the consequence that the president was looking for. So that's the part of the policy debate, managing the personalities. And I had some strong personalities to deal with. Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell. Very, very smart people who know they're smart. And finally, if a president makes a decision and nobody knows about it, did the president make a decision? And the answer is no. And the decisions are so tough, the president usually announces his decision to a chief of staff when he walks into the Oval Office. After having done a lot of homework, met with a lot of people, agonized over it, slept on it, prayed on it, talked to his spouse about it, then is greeted by a very joyful chief of staff, because I always tried to be very optimistic. The last thing you want is a pessimistic president. So I didn't want the president to ever think he was entering a bad day. It was a good day. No matter how bad it was a good day. Because nobody will implement a president's decision if the president says, I think I'm making a bad decision today. So optimism is important, and my job was to be the optimist. And he brought him in, and I would say, "Top of the morning, Mr. President, great day." And he'd say, "I made my decision." The next part of the job, how do you communicate the president's decisions? Marketing and selling. You have to tell a staff. You have to tell a Congress. You have to tell the United Nations. You have prime minister, a king, queen, potentate. That's the job of a chief of staff. So my simple rule is have a process, be disciplined, try not to have it be about you. My goal as chief of staff was to be a chief of staff that nobody knew. Remember the television show Cheers? The theme song, that was a bar in Boston. Loved that show. I wish it didn't go away. But the theme song is the place where everybody knows your name. I wanted to be just the opposite of that. I wanted to be the chief of staff with nobody knew his name. But then Sarasota, Florida, 2001, a perfect day in America. The president is in the classroom with second graders. He had been told before he walked into the classroom that it appears a small twin-engine prop plane crashed into one of the towers at the World Trade Center in New York City. The principal opened the door of the classroom. She and the president went in. All of us thought, by the way, oh, what a horrible accident. The pilot must have had a heart attack or something. And then I was told it wasn't a small twin-engine prop plane. It was a commercial jetliner. And then a nanosecond later, I was told, oh, my God. Another plane hit the other tower at the World Trade Center. And I stood at the door to the classroom. I actually thought about three initials, UBL, Osama bin Laden. I then performed a test the chief of staffs have to perform all the time. Does the president need to know? Sometimes you get it wrong, sometimes you get it right. This was an easy test to pass, yes. I thought about what I would say. I knew the president was sitting in a classroom, kind of on stage, probably with a boom microphone over his head. And I didn't want him to say anything. So I went into the classroom, and I ended up going to his right ear, and he did not know I was coming. And I said, a second plane hit the second tower. America is under attack. And then I stood back from him so he couldn't ask me a question. I was pleased with how he responded because he did nothing to introduce fear to those second graders. He did nothing to demonstrate fear to the media that would have translated it to the satisfaction of the terrorists all around the world. Instead, he sat there and he completed the work that he had to do, and he allowed me to do work that had to be done. So I went into that holding room and I said, get the FBI director on the phone, get a line open to the vice president, get a line open to the White House Situation Room, get the crew back on Air Force One. To the Secret Service, I said, turn the motorcade around, we're going to have to go. To Dan Bartlett and the communication teams, I said, get some remarks written. We've got 600 people in the gymnasium. The president can't say anything that we don't know to be the truth. The president walks into the holding room. The crowd gloms on to him, Mr. President, Mr. President. The first thing he said, get the FBI director on the phone. We could say, he's right here, Mr. President. He transformed that day. I believe that was the day that he became president. And his job was to keep that oath. That document that starts with we has the shortest oath that anybody takes in it. It's in Article 2. It's the oath that the president takes. The job is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. That's the job of the president. The chief of staff's job is to help him do it. John Kelly is doing an outstanding job for President Trump. I'm glad that he's there. He's bringing discipline, especially discipline down. We need a little more discipline up. But I support what our president does because I want him to succeed. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that you have. Thank you for listening. I feel very privileged to have been able to answer a noble call of public service.
Thank you, Andy. Lots of questions, you can imagine. You did discuss just now your reactions and his on 9/11, but a question came in. What was the most difficult challenge you ever had as chief? Was it that day or another time, and how did you handle it?
The most difficult challenge, candidly, is helping the president prepare for the burden that he will carry for the rest of his life. And that is when the president realizes he has to keep his oath by asking others to keep their oaths. And the vast majority of them are very young people. So when the president says, I need help keeping my oath, and he realizes that others have to do the work, and some of them will make sacrifices that the president would never invite on anybody, that's the burden. And so I can't tell you how heavily that weighs on the president. It weighs very heavily on the chief of staff. So you try to make sure that all policy debates that relate to the challenges of protecting our Constitution are done in the context that sacrifices will be made. And that order will come from the president. It doesn't come from anybody else. It comes from the president, and that's the burden the president carries for the rest of his life. So that is by far the greatest challenge, and I could tell you other stories about it, but yes, it was constant. And obviously going to war in Afghanistan, to war in Iraq, weighed heavily on us at the time, continue to weigh heavily on us today, and that's why President George W. Bush is so remarkably involved in anything to do with those who are Gold Star parents or spouses or wounded warriors. So that's the burden.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and moving on from there, how much influence can a chief of staff really have on a president, and were there times, specific times, that you gave him your assessment or your advice and he went the other way?
Yes! Now, a chief of staff should not have disproportionate influence on a president. What they should do is challenge the president to be well-informed, which means challenge the staff to be disciplined in how they inform him. So I tried to be as emotionless as possible in serving the president. I did not want him to make decisions out of emotion. I wanted them to be thoughtful, with good judgment, wisdom, and very high expectations. Because people have to implement what the president says. The White House doesn't get to do anything about implementing policy. They just announce it. Other people have to implement it. And so the job of governing is the challenge for a president. How do you motivate others to be partners in the success of leading? And it could be a government bureaucrat, it could be a member of Congress, it could be a United Nations delegation, it could be a king, queen, potentate, whatever. So the responsibility of governing is what to do. I'm going to give you one example. It's in the public domain, so I feel comfortable talking about it, where the president and I had strong disagreements. And people frequently want me to say, what was it like working for President Reagan? What was it like President George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush? And for me, it's like apples, bananas, and cucumbers. Why? Because I was at a different point in my life. With Ronald Reagan, he was kind of like my grandfather. And you usually don't challenge a grandfather too much. He said, nice old guy, love him. George H.W. Bush, kind of like my dad. Kind of get mad at your dad every once in a while, you feel really guilty about it afterwards. And you keep apologizing. George W. Bush was like my brother. Whew! No problem telling him what I thought. And he had no problem telling me what he thought, which was exactly the right role for a chief of staff. But this issue, you'll probably all remember it. And one of the chief of staff's job is to tell the president, there is a decision coming that you will have to make. And a good president would say, when does it need to be made? And I would say, 2 hours, 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, whatever it was. And then I would say, what do you need to be ready? And he would tell me what he needed to be ready. And George W. Bush was like unbelievably disciplined. He said, I will be ready. If you need the decision in 2 weeks, I will be ready. Well, most of the challenging decisions aren't the ones that are 2 years, 2 months out. They're like 2 hours out. But there was one that was several months out and related to a very emotional and significant policy debate about stem cell research. Stem cell research had been authorized, but it hadn't been funded. So the president was presented with a budget question. The government has the right to do it. They have no money to do it. Do you want to give money to do it? And do you want any constraints on how that money should be spent? And he said, when do I have to make the decision? I said, well, we have to get the bill to Congress. You've got until September, and this was in January. He said, I will be ready. And I watched him put together a process of talking to ethicists, clergy, children's parents who had childhood diabetes, members of the Senate and the House, bipartisan, lots of experts. And the president spent a lot of time meeting with people and reading documents. When it comes time to the penultimate moment when you have to put the money in the budget and then get ready to acknowledge it, he convened a meeting in the Oval Office, and it was a large meeting. There were over 20 people at the meeting. And he heard one more argument from five or six different views, and then he went around the room, which was something unusual for him. He said, tell me what you'd do. And everybody in the room gave their opinions. And then he turned to me and he says, Andy, what would you do? I said, Mr. President, you know that I usually wait until you're all done and I get to tell you which of these people are afraid to talk because they were intimidated by the person beside them. And then you can make the decision. He says, I want to hear what your answer is right now. And I told him what my answer was. That I would fund it. I would put very few restrictions on it. And then he left. Everybody left the meeting. We went off. The next morning he came and I greeted him with the optimism. Top of the morning, Mr. President, great day. He said, you're not going to think it's a great day. I said, ooh, excuse me, Mr. President. He says, I made my decision and I don't think you're going to like it. And I said, I can tell you this much. I respect it. And he said, well, it's on stem cell. I said, I respect it. I respect how you did it, what you did to get ready, and I respect that it's your decision to make. And I am very comfortable implementing it. So that was one example. There were many, but that's one in the public domain.
Great. Coming up to date and adopting some language we've heard a lot on TV, is the swamp too deep to ever be drained?
If anyone knows how hard it is to drain a swamp, it's the people in Florida. You have America's swamp. My counsel to, this relates to President Trump, my counsel to the President Trump team was, anyone in Florida knows you don't go into the swamp without a guide. So don't presume that everyone who is in the swamp is the enemy. Some of them are in the swamp because they're good guides. And you need good guides around you. So I think it's really hard to drain the swamp. I'm excited that President Trump was elected as a change agent. And I think what happened, I supported Jeb. I didn't support Donald Trump. But my wife anticipated his victory. And she said that to me many, many times. And yes, I think President Trump responded to that which too many people are frustrated about and said, it's not working, they've left me behind, it's all about Washington, D.C. and the bureaucrats and not enough about what we think is right. So I understand that, and I respect that. But I also think the ways of Washington are such that the president needs to invite people to be part of the solution rather than just dictate that they be part of the solution. And if you have the right invitation, back to that we in the Constitution, invitations are very powerful. Help me solve this problem and you can. But I hope the swamp gets drained, but I don't think it will ever be completely drained. And one reason I'm not that nervous about every swamp preacher disappearing is that some swamp preachers actually are pretty smart. And I'm going to... Abraham Lincoln was the founder of the Republican Party. He founded an inclusive party, and that was wonderful. I loved the party that he founded. John Adams gave us the Constitution. He didn't sit and write the Constitution because he was actually serving as an ambassador in France, so he wasn't around. But John Adams wrote the Massachusetts Constitution, which is the oldest working constitution in the world, and that's what the U.S. Constitution was copied on. And John Adams said when he wrote the Massachusetts Constitution, after North Carolina said, "Help, we need a government. Can you write something for us?" And he said, "I'll send you a note." And he did. It's called Thoughts on Government. You should read it. You can Google it and get it. He says, you need the following if you're going to have a government. You have to need a group of people who are close to the public. We call it a house. They should be elected by the public. They should be so close to them that they understand their concerns, but they should be far enough away from them that they can exercise judgment and not be subject to mob rule. So make sure you're separated from the mob. Then he said, the mob is so dangerous, and Plato and Aristotle told us that you need another branch, an upper branch, that will get to exercise judgment and wisdom. And they should be a little further away from the people. And no law should come without those two branches exercising judgment and then judgment and wisdom to write a law. And then they said, you always need an executive, and by the way, you should never trust him. So don't ever give him the power of the purse. But you need somebody to run the government. Just make sure they're not secure in it and make sure they move on after a few years. And then since you can't trust anybody who gets power, make sure there's a third branch that the other two branches have nothing to do with except inviting them to take the position. And that's the courts. That's what John Adams said. I think that's a very wise way to look at it right now, and that's what I think we should do.
Here's a tough one, Andy. I know we talked about this before privately. George W. Bush was silent during the 8 years, generally speaking, the Obama years, okay? Why is George and his father, why are they now criticizing their own president?
I did anticipate this question. I was with both Presidents Bush within the last 10 days. And people presume I'm closest to George W. Bush because I was his chief of staff. Like, we were really close acquaintances, but I was much closer to his parents. And I try to check in with the first President Bush every Friday, because I love him. And George W. Bush and I spent an hour and a half last week just sitting talking, and that was great. It's wonderful to sit in a rocking chair and reflect on yesterday. But one of the things we talked about was the exact quote that is causing you to ask questions about George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush in the context of Donald Trump. So I did my homework with the sources. George H.W. Bush was approached in May by Mr. Updegrove, who wrote the book, and was interviewed about his thoughts of Donald Trump in May, not of this year, in May of last year. Jeb Bush had just withdrawn from the race for president. So his comment about Donald Trump being a blowhard came in the context of a campaign where his son was abused by the blowhard. And so I can understand that. I do know that George H.W. Bush was the first former president to call Donald Trump when he won the presidency. And there is no one who I know who personifies respect for the Oval Office than George H.W. Bush. And he has great respect for the Oval Office and the occupant. He may not agree with them. So I thought it was unfair for that quote to come out now, because we see it in the context of Donald Trump today. It was the context of Donald Trump having just called his son, not a very favorable thing, who had just withdrawn from the race for the presidency. George W. Bush gave his quote before the election, when he was just interviewed about the process and Donald Trump running for office. And it wasn't very complimentary. But it was before the election. He also has been very respectful in speaking to President Trump and about President Trump and what he's been doing. So the one thing, people ask what I miss about being chief of staff, and it would be easy to say, working with people like Carnot, would be easy to say the pomp and circumstance, the excitement of going to the White House mess, of feeling like a big shot. Those are all kind of cool. The truth is, what I miss the most is the information I had as chief of staff. I had great information. But I also read the newspaper every day. And I would read the newspaper before I went to work. I get up about 4:08 in the morning. My wife is a minister, Philippians 4:8. I don't know why she picked that verse, but boy, that's early time to get up. Think of all that is good, noble, and just. Think of those things. Philippians 4:8. Other friends say there are other Bible verses that start with 6. I would read the newspaper, and I'd read the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and I'd kind of snicker at the papers because no one ever had it right. There was something off a little bit. The context was, you could find out who's leaking this. I can understand that view. They don't have it right. And I would know because I would kind of know what was right. So I'd get to work, and I would discount what I read in the newspapers and just say, keep your head in the game, focus on what we're doing, keep doing what you're doing, I'll discipline this person or tell them what ought to do. I leave office, I read the newspapers, and I know it's not right, but I don't know why. So don't believe everything you read in the newspapers or in the books, unless you're reading fiction. But anyway.
Okay, several people asked, and I know we don't have too much time. Quick answer here, if it can be. Is the current chief of staff, John Kelly, doing a good job? Is he doing anything you would not do? And if you could give him one quick piece of advice today, what would it be?
I do think he's doing a very good job. I think he's a very good job. If I would give him advice about something that he has done that didn't contribute, I would try to stay out of the news rather than get into it. But I think it was important at least one of the times when he was in the news. I think the second time it might have been better if he wasn't, because it kept the debate going. So I don't want to see stories about the chief of staff. I like to see stories about the president that the chief of staff defends. But so I would say, but I give him very high marks. I have great respect for him. In the little trivia world, who graduated from UMass Boston with General John Kelly in the room? I know, my wife. John Kelly graduated from UMass Boston the same year that my wife graduated from UMass Boston after having been married, and she started at UMass Amherst, finished at UMass Boston when I was in the legislature, but she graduated with John Kelly. She didn't know it at the time, and he didn't either. He probably still doesn't know it.
Thank you, Andy, and I
Thank
know
you
a lot
much.
Of your remarks.
God bless you.
Don't go away. Stay.